The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
As human beings, as living beings, I think we have our share of difficulty. We don't get through a life, I think, without experiencing some, or even a lot. And the Buddha's word for difficulty, maybe difficulty isn't a bad translation for dukkha. A Pali word that is usually translated as suffering. And so, you know, there's so much going on right now. So many different tragedies happening in our country. And one of the pieces around difficulty and dukkha that the Buddha pointed us to, one way to look at what the Buddha was talking about, was opening to difficulty, turning towards difficulty, not running from it, not repressing it, and also not necessarily just moving immediately to trying to fix or change or deal with some kind of situation, but to open to, first of all, I think the Buddha pointed to opening to the suffering that's coming around difficulty. Because from that place of opening to it, of allowing our hearts to be open to suffering, either our own or in the world, in our communities, in our country, on our planet, and opening to it, not resisting it or pushing it away, we find our way to compassion, to a form of action that is motivated not from fear or aversion or resistance or repulsion, but from an open heart. And this, I think this is really what the Buddha was pointing to when he, in the First Noble Truth, said, suffering should be understood. I think this is what he meant, that it should be turned towards, not understood so much in the intellectual way, but in the way of, what does it mean to meet suffering? What does it mean to have a heart that's open to let suffering touch us? And this letting suffering touch us . The response to the heart when we really let suffering touch us is compassion. It is this movement of the heart to quiver in response to suffering. And compassion does want to act. It does want to alleviate suffering. But from a perspective of that, wanting to alleviate suffering, not from the perspective of resisting suffering, not from the perspective of fighting, pushing away suffering. It's an interesting experience to open to that and see that the heart can allow suffering to touch us. And then we move into action, not because we are afraid or resistant or confused, but because of clarity and wisdom and love. And so this turning towards suffering, turning towards dukkha, turning towards difficulty is a piece that I'd like to explore today. This what this means and how we can practice with this. I'm firmly convinced that our own work with this in our own hearts, opening to our own suffering, creates the conditions for us to be able to more easily open to the suffering of others, and perhaps creates the conditions for a more collective response to the suffering in the world from compassion rather than anger or hatred. So this word dukkha, you know, the word dukkha has different meanings in the texts. Actually, it can mean unpleasantness. So just unpleasant experience, and this we can think of this as just being pain. You know, if we cut ourselves with a knife, or we fall down and injure ourselves, there will be physical pain, and that's a form of dukkha, a form of unpleasant experience. So that word dukkha is used for that just objective unpleasantness. And I think we can also know in a way the experience of meeting the suffering in the world as that kind of thing too. When we open to or we recognize that other people are suffering, there's a kind of a pain in the heart that feels, it's like we're designed to feel pain when we see another feeling pain. And so that, in a way, that's a kind of that dukkha, the dukkha of unpleasantness. When we open to the pain of seeing the grief and the sorrow and the sadness of all the people who have been affected by the hurricanes and the earthquakes and the fires and the mass shooting in Las Vegas. The pain there is kind of a objective pain that's happening for so many people. And when we see that, when we meet that, our heart feels something. And that's that we can look at that as being a part of that, the dukkha of unpleasant. And we, I'll go through the three first. And then the second is, the second use of the term is unreliability. That basically, because experience is impermanent, all things that happen are impermanent, there's no experience or situation or state that is reliable as a place where we can find lasting happiness. And just the truth that things change, everything changes. What we own, our possessions, our lives, our health, our states of mind, the opinions other people have of us, all those change. And so there's nothing that's reliable where we can say, oh, I finally figured it out. This is where I find happiness. This is happiness forever. Because inherently the change means that any happiness that we're finding in dependence on changing conditions is unreliable. So that's the second use of this word, dukkha. And then the third use of the word dukkha is what I would call, let's see if I can adjust this so it won't get the... Can you still hear? If it's there? Okay, I'll try that. The third kind of dukkha I would call reactivity. It's what happens to us basically as we respond to these first two kinds of dukkha. Basically, I think that's what this reactivity is. And so there's this third kind of dukkha is when we are in relationship with either things that are unpleasant and we don't like them, we resist them, we're afraid or wanting to control or fix or change. We're not opening to that unpleasantness as being, oh, this is the way it is. Allowing it to touch us, allowing that difficulty to touch us. Instead, we are kind of contracted and resisting it. We're pushing it away or holding on to something, some idea or view about how things should be instead. And so we also react to unreliability if something is, you know, that we like, we have it, we want it, hold on to it, and if we see that it changes, it goes, we resist that. We don't like that it changes. We want to hold on to it. And so essentially, you know, we react to physical pain, we react to what other people do and say, we react to situations in the world, we react to our own states of mind, we react to situations in our lives. We like some things, we don't like some things. And so this piece is another kind of dukkha. And the Buddha pointed to this kind of reactivity. Reactivity we could basically define as states that are based in wanting things to be some other way, or states based in confusion. And so, you know, wanting something, you know, resisting or reacting, pushing away the unpleasant, holding on to the pleasant, this push-pull we have around experience. And the reactivity itself, it's a little more of an understanding that we gain, that the reactivity is a form of suffering, because so much what we think, our relationship to reactivity, is we think that reactivity is helping us to navigate the world. We think that reactivity is helping us to navigate this kind of physical unpleasantness and this unreliability. And so we think that this reactivity is doing something for us, helping us to kind of find our way among all of the suffering and struggle and pain and sorrow and unreliability in the world. And so we don't really, at times, unless we start looking, turning towards reactivity, much as I'm encouraging this kind of exploration of turning towards difficulty, turning towards suffering, turning towards whatever is experienced as suffering. When we start to turn towards reactivity, not to try to fix it or change it or push it away, but to explore understanding it, as the Buddha again pointed to in the First Noble Truth. So all three forms of this dukkha, the Buddha encouraged us to understand it. And not in an intellectual way, not thinking about it. What is this suffering? How did I get here? How can I fix this? That's not what the Buddha meant by understanding dukkha. In my own journey here, my understanding is what he's pointing to is a turning towards the experience of suffering. With mindfulness and curiosity, what is this human experience of dukkha? And so this question of turning towards suffering, turning towards what is this human experience of dukkha, at all levels of dukkha, all kinds of dukkha, this is kind of the basis for our responsiveness to the world. And as we explore the possibility of turning towards an opening to dukkha, it changes how we respond to the world. And so we can explore, what does it mean to open to the suffering of so many people who have lost their homes in these fires, or the people who are survivors from the shootings in Las Vegas? What does it mean to open to that? to open our hearts to that pain. Often I think one of the things that happens when we open to something, especially some of the big kinds of suffering that we meet in our journey as human beings, you know, our mind just, sometimes it feels like it can't hold it or it gets overwhelmed. And so it goes into different modes so that it doesn't have to feel that pain. It goes into, maybe it just checks out. I've had enough. I can't be with that. Or it goes into, well, I'm going to do all of these things to make sure that I don't get caught in a situation like that. Or it goes into fix it mode. And I want to be careful in how I talk about this, because when our heart does move into action in the face of suffering, there is a piece of that action that is often motivated by a genuine compassion. And I've heard so many stories of people in the last few months who have just selflessly given of their time and their resources to support people in need. And I think we still need to look at, are we avoiding, in the movement towards action, is a piece of that wanting to avoid feeling. A piece of it is clearly wanting to step into action and to act out of that compassionate heart. In some ways, I think these disasters bring out the best in people at times. It really, we open to the suffering in a different way, and we do step up. As in general, as a community, we step up to support each other. And we do need to recognize what part of that is coming from that genuine wish to support and to help from the open-hearted feeling. That's what I'd encourage an exploration of, as you open to or turn towards suffering. Turn towards difficulty on the large scale. Does the heart feel like it can stay open as it's acting? If that action is coming and the feeling of the open heart is there, that's trustable, that's trustworthy. If there's a kind of a constriction, closing down, a clamping down around the suffering, and the mind is just kind of in a do-it mode, there probably still is some of that compassion motivating it. But my guess is, and this is, I think, one of the causes for burnout when people are caregivers and when people are volunteering in challenging situations, that the heart gets kind of shut down. And we keep pushing through. We keep pushing. We keep pushing. And so we're not honoring that we may need to open to explore the opening of the heart again. And to explore maybe taking a rest for ourselves in order to be able to serve more fully. And so, the fix-it mode. I think that the main piece that I'll encourage in looking at taking action in the face of suffering is, does the heart feel open and resonant, or does the heart feel hard and anxious? And if that's happening, then it's probably useful to take some time to hold that to turn towards that, because that's a kind of a form of reactivity to the suffering. When the heart gets hard, when the heart feels like it's constricted or collapsed or kind of walled in around suffering, then there's a kind of reactivity there to the suffering. We will have that kind of reactivity to pain, to unreliability. There's almost no way that we'll get through life without having that. And so this is a big piece of our practice, is learning to explore the inner reactivity that comes as we meet suffering. So the turning towards, this is a piece of human experience. Whatever is happening in our hearts is part of our humanity. It's part of our human experience. And if anger or shame or confusion or hatred or rage or depression or pride or wanting are coming up, as we turn towards them, earlier I was talking about how we those kind of reactivities, we don't often see or experience so much as suffering initially, because we're thinking of them as useful to help us navigate suffering. But what we start to see as we turn towards the kind of reactivity that we have, as we turn towards our own inner hardness of heart, our own inner pushing away, our own wanting to hold on, to fix, to change, to solidify. As we turn towards that and explore, okay, this too is human suffering. Much as what's happening out there is human suffering, this too is human suffering. And this deserves to be met with a kind attention, with a loving attention. Much as we explore the open heart in meeting the pain of others, we explore the open heart in meeting our own hearts and minds. And as we do that, as we turn towards what is this human experience of reactivity, what we begin to recognize is that the reactivity has been kind of fooling us in terms of thinking that it's helping us somehow. I had this really clear recognition about this pretty early in my practice around anger. I was angry at a particular person, and at some point I began to recognize that I thought that this anger was going to make the other person miserable. Somehow that was a piece of what the anger was doing. And I could see that there was some kind of belief in my mind that I would feel better if the other person was miserable. I mean, that's humbling to see that in the first place, to think somehow I would feel better if somebody else felt miserable. I mean, that's kind of humbling to see that. But in the process of observing this, of turning towards the experience of anger, which was what I was doing at the time, I saw that was a belief that it was going to make the other person miserable. And in this particular situation, it was completely clear to me that this was a completely deluded belief, because I happened to be 7,000 miles away from this other person. I was in an island in the middle of the South Pacific, and this person was in California, and this person did not even really know I was angry. So there was no way that this person was going to feel the effects of my rage and my anger. And so the delusion of that was exposed. The belief that somehow it was doing something for me to get angry was exposed. And the other thing that was exposed was that while I was experiencing the anger, I was suffering. It hurt me. It was painful. The experience of anger was painful. And so this piece, those three things together, kind of turned the mind in a different direction around the anger, and had it recognize that the mind had been so confused about the benefits of anger. I would say, to that point and beyond that point still, my mind was really, it had been trained towards the direction of anger. That was a very familiar deep rut, and it believed that there was some value not really clearly understanding the suffering here and now that this being was experiencing when the anger was present. And this is true around all forms of reactivity. When we open to them with this kind of exploration that the Buddha is pointing us to, mindfulness, opening to what is the human experience of whatever reactivity is present, we see that that reactivity hurts here and now. Wanting to hold on to something, that actually feels unpleasant here and now. It hurts here and now. Anger, rage, depression, confusion, they all have a kind of an agitated, constricted quality to them that we feel here and now. Some of them are more, they're easier to see than others. I mean, it actually was not very hard for me to recognize that anger hurt me once I began being curious about, well, what is this experience of anger? It wasn't that hard to see how painful anger was. It's a little harder to see how painful something like desire or wanting is, craving, because the mind so quickly moves to the wanting has a view in it, that a belief that it's going to do something for me. What it's going to do for me is it's going to get that thing that I want. And in that view or that belief that when I get that thing, I'll be happy, we are missing. The mind is kind of jumping over and is not aware of, it's ignoring, it's deluded about the pain of the experience of that craving itself, the pain of the wanting itself. Now again, this isn't to say that we're not, that we would never do anything or never take action, never desire something. Desires can actually be motivated out of compassion, out of care, out of kindness for ourselves and for others. And so what I'm pointing to is a kind of a wanting or a reaching out to get something out of a kind of a neediness or a sense that that is going to make me happy. That kind of relying on that unreliable thing. And so we if we start to turn towards, and I think that this actually, you know, in my own experience, when I look at the wanting that's associated with the wanting to help somebody in need or the wanting to act out of kindness or compassion, that kind of wanting, there's an open-hearted quality to it. It doesn't feel constricted and tight. And so the feeling, to me, the feeling in the heart is a good kind of guide for us in terms of, because in the movement towards compassion, the feeling in the heart, that the quivering in the heart is not felt in the same way that reactivity is felt. It feels a little bit, you know, it feels like, yeah, I want to do something to alleviate the suffering. It's a quivering. Jack Kornfield calls compassion the quivering of the heart in the face of suffering. But to me, that quivering, that the heart feels, it feels like jello. It's like it's resonating in response to suffering. It's not hard. It's not resisting. It's not pushing. It's not like stiff and constricted. And so in turning towards our experience, often when we turn towards our experience and reactivity is there will be this kind of constricted feeling in the area of the heart. And so that we feel as pain, as suffering. And so our hearts begin to recognize as we turn towards that suffering, inner suffering, as we turn towards that inner reactivity and are curious about it with mindfulness, we do recognize it as a form of suffering rather than as a form of something that's going to help us deal with things in the world. And so this is a different kind of experience, a different kind of relationship to that world of reactivity. So a couple of the key things in terms of working with this kind of exploring, what does it mean to turn towards? What does that mean, turning towards experience? Turning towards reactivity. What I would say there, in terms of our inner reactivity, we're turning towards our inner experience of anger or confusion or hatred or rage or frustration or irritation or disappointment or so many different emotions that we have. Turning towards that experience. It's really useful to... I sometimes ask that question, well, what's it feel like to be a human being experiencing this? And let my mind kind of recede from the thing or situation that I'm reacting to. And so if I'm reacting to a coworker, or if I'm reacting to a situation or an idea or a headline, if I'm reacting to something, I let my attention kind of, maybe let the attention come more towards the experience of the feeling, and let the attention kind of come out of the thing that you think that you're reacting to. And I say think that you're reacting to because I'm going to explore a piece about that in a moment too. So we think we're reacting to something that's out there. And so let the attention come inwardly, potentially exploring the body. How does it feel in the body to be a human being experiencing this emotion? This is usually most easily done when you have some space or time. May not be able to do this if you're in the midst of a conversation with somebody. So how does it feel to be a human being experiencing that? And exploring the possibility of holding that with kindness, having an open heart towards whatever that reactivity is. It's kind of a little bit of a paradox at times. It's almost like we let our heart, our mind get a little bigger than the reactivity, and the reactivity is held in the middle of a heart that maybe can hold it with a sense of allowing, a sense of friendliness, of kindness, of caring. Like if you saw somebody else experiencing the pain of frustration or confusion or depression, you might be able to hold that with a sense of open-heartedness. And so perhaps you can explore that possibility for yourself also. When we explore this, when we turn towards reactivity inwardly, it's often interesting and sometimes mind-blowing, sometimes quite startling, to begin to be curious about what is it that we are actually reacting to. And we think that, you know, we're reacting to whatever's out there, the situation, the person, the headline, the action of some other person. We think that that's the problem, that that's what we're reacting to. And yet, sometimes when we turn and start actually exploring what's happening inside, what's going on in here, we see that there is something out there that's kind of happening that is in the field or in the mix of how the reactivity is created. But the actual thing we're reacting to is usually something happening in our own minds. Some idea, some belief, some view. So on one retreat, I was exploring this question of what am I actually reacting to? What's actually going on in there? How is this reactivity happening anyway? My teacher had said, you know, if you're experiencing aversion, there's something unpleasant happening in your experience. And so what is it? What is the unpleasantness? And so I began exploring that possibility, and at one point doing walking meditation, I noticed a lot of aversion while I was doing walking meditation. It seemed to be a pattern, and so I began to get curious about it. What was going on in the walking meditation? And in particular, I seemed to have a lot of aversion when the rooms got crowded, when the walking rooms got crowded. And at one point, I was doing walking meditation, and the room was pretty full. And somebody else came in and slipped in right next to me, where it didn't seem like there was much space. You know, that I was walking, you know, probably 2 feet from the person next to me, and somebody came in the middle, and so, you know, we all kind of had to adjust. But there was this big explosion of aversion in my mind. And so I got curious. And ostensibly, you know, my mind was saying, you know, that person shouldn't have done that. They should have done walking meditation elsewhere. You know, that they should have seen there wasn't enough room there. You know, why didn't they do something else instead? And so that, you know, that was kind of the place my mind started with in terms of the reactivity. It's like, that person is causing the reactivity. That person is making me averse. That was the way my mind was feeling. Well, I've got some good news here, actually, because nobody actually has the power to make us feel anything. There are conditions that people... things that people do in the world that land in our minds that we respond to, that we react to, and that is where the reactivity is born, is inside. It's, you know, I used to feel like I was covered with buttons, and you know, people could just come up and say, boom, push a button, and I would freak out or get depressed or get angry or whatever. And so I felt like people had control over me. And what this practice began to show me is that, you know, so I was basically offering the button to somebody. I was saying, here, push this button. And what I began to recognize is how much was in the realm of views and ideas and thoughts. And so in this example, I started getting curious. Well, what's actually unpleasant here? And in this case, I decided I'd go through each of the sense bases. I'd go through each of the senses, and started with sight. The person didn't look unpleasant, so I didn't see anything unpleasant in the realm of sight. They weren't making noise. I didn't experience anything unpleasant in the realm of sound. It wasn't coming in taste or smell. They weren't touching me. And so the five physical senses were ruled out pretty quickly. And so it's like, okay, well, something unpleasant is happening in the mind. What is it? What is unpleasant happening in the mind? And it wasn't so clear to me, actually, initially. And so I just kept walking, and I said, well, there must be something going on in there. And I just kept walking, kind of just being curious about what's going on in the mind. And then at some point, the thought came into the mind, he's weird. And I kind of took notice of that thought. And Still didn't recognize that as being particularly unpleasant. But then a little bit later, maybe 30-40 seconds later, I saw the thought, he's in bare feet and it's freezing cold out with this kind of, you know, and then really recognizing that the mind was feeling unpleasant about these ideas about this person. And that was where, that was what the mind was reacting to. That the mind was reacting to the ideas about the person and not about the person themselves. That was quite eye-opening to me to recognize. And that I've seen over and over and over and over and over again. Whenever there's something going on where there's reactivity, there's almost always some kind of belief or view or idea at work. And so that's a really useful question to ask yourself, or a useful exploration when you turn towards the reactivity and are holding it with mindfulness is, well, first of all, to explore, you know, what is actually being reacted to? And I think looking at if it's a reactivity that's an aversive kind of reactivity, it's like, what's unpleasant here? Because when there is aversion, some kind of unpleasantness is happening that the mind is not clearly knowing and clearly recognizing. And so that's a useful thing to look at, what's pleasant or unpleasant here that the mind is reacting to? If there's a wanting, what is it that the mind actually wants? Another experience I had around wanting, I was again on retreat and noticing this kind of suffering I was experiencing around wanting to have certain kinds of meditation experiences. I really wanted to have certain, you know, things that the teachers were talking about. I so wanted to have those experiences. And I was, you know, feeling a lot of suffering around that. And I began exploring, well, what is it? What is it that I want here? And I began to recognize that I had no idea, actually, the state. I mean, they described something. So my mind created some idea about maybe what that would be. But actually, when I began looking at this, what I saw that the mind really wanted, because I kept seeing myself, I kept seeing myself going into the interview room to report to the teacher that I'd had one of these great experiences that they'd been talking about. That's what I saw myself thinking about. And that was a pleasant fantasy. That was what I wanted, to be able to go in and describe teacher that I'd had an experience. Like, I had no idea what I wanted. I had no idea the actual experience that I thought that I wanted. I just wanted to have that teacher think that I was a good yogi. And boy, that really burst that bubble. It's like, I don't actually, what am I actually wanting here? Isn't the meditation experience itself. It's some idea of having a teacher think I've had that meditation experience. And so looking at what is it actually that we are reacting to? What is it that the mind wants? What is it? And each time I've seen these kinds of things, each time the mind has been able to see this kind of, you know, it's basically stuff going on below the level of our usual level of what we think of as the subconsciousness. You know, that thought about telling my teacher what I'd experienced, it became clear just by being willing to be there with the feeling of wanting around that experience. And so this opening to mindfulness, and then being curious, perhaps, you know, well, what is pleasant here? What is unpleasant here? What is it that I actually want? What is it that I actually want to get rid of? What's going on? And then also at times the question, what's being believed? You know, this kind of thing, this kind of view or belief that we react to, is also part of why we constrict down, why we suffer around, you know, the larger sufferings in the world. You know, the shootings in Las Vegas, for instance, you know, the mind maybe feels like, you know, it moves into the, we need gun control, that's the problem here. This wouldn't have happened if we didn't have gun control. And you know, so the mind maybe moves into that. And it's, you know, so there's, there, in there is, you know, this wouldn't have happened if some other situation had been. And so, and somebody's to blame for that. And it's not me to blame for that. So there's all kinds of thoughts and views and beliefs going on in there. And it, I'm not saying that you shouldn't, like, that you shouldn't hold those with some measure of value. You know, it may be that your calling may be to be a lobbyist about gun control, and that's a calling. That may be something that's done out of compassion and care and love. And yet there's times when we, you know, we're wrapped into the reactivity. So there's, again, the question of reactivity. Are we in reactivity about somebody's to blame? Somebody is, and does the heart feel hard around the situation? Does the heart feel constricted around the situation? If it does, then there's something going on inwardly. Because it is possible for the heart to be open to whatever is going on. It is possible for the heart to be open. And any time the heart feels constricted or closed, there's something inwardly that can be held, seen, felt, open to, understood, that will allow a release of that constriction, that will allow us to act from compassion, to act from wisdom and generosity and kindness. And so that turning towards will help us to find the way to that open heart. It's a staged release. It's not something that happens just because we decide to do that. We decide to start looking at our hearts. Part of what we get to feel at times is that constriction and at times it's overwhelming. At times we have to set it aside and let our hearts have a break from that. But at times we can hold it with some measure of allowing. And in that, something else starts to happen. A shifting and a changing of the heart. And partly because of what I pointed to earlier, that, you know, the heart starts to recognize that it's contributing to its own pain. And it starts to recognize the parts of that pain that can be released. It starts to understand that the constriction and the hardening of the heart is optional and can be released. And then we are moving in the world with a heart that's much more resilient and resonant, resonating with suffering, with the feeling of compassion, resonating with joy, with the feeling of joy, resonating with connection and love. And so to me, the wisdom that the Buddha offers of understanding suffering, because that's fundamentally his wisdom teaching. You know, understand suffering, turn towards it, open to it. And that opening to it creates the conditions for this transformation, this releasing of the hardness, the pain. And yet that opening to that wisdom, it's not like we just become these dull, indifferent, unfeeling beings. We actually, I feel, become more felt. We feel more. We feel more when our heart is open than we do when our heart is closed. So we have a couple of minutes if there's any thoughts or reflections, questions. You're first.
Is it on?
Yeah. Is it on?
It's on.
Okay.
I had a question.
I think it's not... I don't think it's amplifying, though.
Okay. I had a question about basically turning inwards towards unpleasant feelings. So I kind of sometimes try to just see the body sensations, like I think you've mentioned. But sometimes I feel like I see if I react with anger or, you know, by shouting or something, I see that it doesn't help. Sure. But I do see that with, like, I don't know if I'm deluded or it's true. Like, I feel when I cry, it kind of just like opens it up or lets it out. So is it okay to react in that manner or like... I don't know how to deal with that.
To yell?
Or
to cry?
Is it okay to cry?
I mean...
It's like absolutely okay to cry.
Like, I feel that that's like an outlet and it kind of helps, but
yeah.
Is that like a delusion or can it actually help?
It can help. It absolutely can help. I mean, it's. I think what often happens... the crying is kind of a physiological response that allows the release of chemicals from our body, and so, you know, it can help. I think what would be useful to look at is there an indulging in crying? Is there a kind of sometimes when I cry, it just feels like the tears just spring to my eyes. It's just, you know, when I read something that is so, that touches me, it's like it just happens. And so does it feel like you're kind of wallowing in something to cry? Or does it feel like it's allowing a release? Sometimes it's almost like we're leaning into that. It's almost like, oh, poor me. Oh, I'm so sad and I'm never going to get this right and I'm always going to be a failure. And if those kinds of thoughts are going through your mind, that's a kind of wallowing.
Right.
And so... you might just explore allowing the crying to happen, but turning towards just the feeling and letting go of the thoughts, if there's any thoughts around it.
Okay.
But yeah, it's fine to cry, and it will happen.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thanks. And it's time to stop, so thank you.